This is Making Conversation, the Australian Composers Podcast. In this episode, we're delighted to share an interview between Stephanie Eslake and Tasmanian-based composer Maria Grenfell.
Hello and welcome to the Making Conversation podcast series, coming to you now from that little island called Tasmania. I'm Stephanie Eslake and I'm here with the incredibly talented composer Maria Grenfell. Thanks for joining us, Maria.
Thanks, Steph.
We're talking in your Tasmanian home, which is tucked away in a cul-de-sac near the Derwent River. Your family home upstairs and downstairs is where the music happens. So talk us through this space a little bit.
So I tend to work in my study in the evening. Most of the time, my husband David Malone is a guitarist, and so he needs a space to practice, and I need a space that's reasonably quiet. But when we had two children, we have two children now, and they have sort of taken over our rooms, but we still have enough rooms, fortunately, to have a little study each.
How long does it take you to write a composition, and does it all happen in this house downstairs in your studio?
Yes, it does. It would probably take anywhere between maybe 3 to 6 months working solidly on an orchestral piece, probably a little less time for a chamber piece. But I find it very difficult to work solidly at the moment because I have quite a huge teaching and administrative load, and I find it does take its toll on my energy levels and my capacity to think clearly. So I do tend to give myself as much time as possible, if it's possible.
I'd like you to take us back to the beginning of your career. So you were born in Malaysia.
Yes.
You went to New Zealand where you studied music at the University of Canterbury.
Yes.
And I'm wondering how you came to know that music was what you wanted to do and when that sort of struck you in life.
When I was in high school, I was doing a lot of music, but I was also very interested in other subjects, and I was quite keen to do an arts degree with a little bit of music, but it didn't really work out that way, and I ended up doing composition sort of by default in many ways at university. And it was probably around the time of my end of my second year or third year that I really started to enjoy composition. I actually found it very challenging at first, not technically difficult, but it was sort of emotionally hard to get interested in, because I was actually really had my heart set on being an orchestral musician. I played the violin since I was 9, and I really, really wanted to be a violinist and do performance. But it just turned out that I wasn't really cut out for all the performing, you know, the solo performance, the many, many, many hours of practice. And so I started becoming more interested in what I was doing for composition. Mm. And so I ended up staying for a little bit longer at University of Canterbury and did honours and masters in composition. And that's really where I thought I could really do something with this. And I was starting to get small commissions as well.
Mm.
Yeah.
Did you find that because you had that background sort of love of the violin, that found its way into your earlier compositions?
No, I wrote barely anything for violin.
Oh.
Yeah, and I was much more interested in writing for instruments that I didn't really know about, and also writing for instruments that I knew people would be able to play my pieces. In fact, the very first piece I ever had performed at a composer's workshop, I love telling people this, was a song that I wrote for baritone and viola, and the baritone was Teddy Rhodes.
Oh.
Because he was a year ahead of me at uni in Canterbury, because he's from Christchurch.
Mm.
Yeah.
So after Canterbury, you went to the United States for further study. So yes. You studied in New York and Los Angeles. Why the moving around so much?
What happened was I finished my master's at Eastman, and I had been offered a place to do my doctorate at the University of Southern California in Los Angeles. And they offered me a teaching assistantship too, which paid all of the fees and also gave me two classes to teach with a small stipend attached to it. And I didn't really have any idea just how good that an offer that was. So I thought, yes, okay, I'll take it up. But I wasn't committed to seeing out the whole thing. But I ended up staying and completing the doctorate. When I was doing my doctorate and I had this teaching assistantship, I hadn't really done any classroom teaching before ever. And some people find they have a knack for it. And I found that I did have a knack for teaching. I found it really a big learning curve at the very beginning, but I got better at it. And so I was doing quite a lot of teaching because I found that I was fairly comfortable with it. And I got some good feedback from students. And so it seemed to be the reasonable thing to finish a doctorate and apply for a teaching position.
Did you apply for a teaching position in Tasmania? Is that when you made the move to across the continents?
Yes, I did. Well, I also applied for jobs in the US, but you get, 500 people applying for one single job. I flew out here and started in July of 1998, which was halfway through the academic year for University of Tasmania.
How did external sort of forces like the ideas of the students that you were teaching impact on your own work?
It was quite separate.
How would you describe your early works?
Very tonal or very modal. I was surrounded by composers who were writing very much more experimental music, and that was the type of music that I was first introduced to at university, and I found that really confronting. But I remain very grateful to my teachers who never said to me, stop writing tonal music, stop writing modal music, you must write in a different style. They never said that to me. And I think it's really important for teachers to encourage students to try and find their own style, but not force them into writing in a different style.
What's your own style now?
One of my teachers says that my style is post-atonal, and I'm not quite sure what that means. I think I've sort of travelled the journey from writing very tonal music to writing very atonal music to kind of meeting in the middle a little bit, with probably a bit more emphasis on the tonal style. But I don't really like to use that label with my music. So my music often will be influenced or inspired by an extra musical idea, like a painting or a poem or a folk song.
Do you think that those sorts of labels you were talking about shouldn't be forced upon new compositions?
Yeah, I think it's more about the type of ideas you're trying to communicate and the type of voice that you become associated with, rather than the type of harmonic language that you're using.
How does that work with what you're teaching at university? Because I would imagine you teach those labels and terms, but then coming from that personal background of not liking to necessarily label something, how do you find that balance?
Well, I mean, it's, I think, a curriculum issue. I think music students need to know about the tools of music, and they learn it from looking at music of the past. And so most music schools teach common practice harmony, for example, in first year and second year, and then they learn about post-tonal or atonal music. Teaching composition is different to teaching harmony, but I think it's important that we don't throw the baby out with the bathwater, and that we actually have respect for the traditions of the past and how they can apply to compositional techniques that we use that have been developed out of those traditions.
You've had about 11 symphony commissions and composed about 40 pieces. So how does your own music fit in with this idea of contemporary composition or new music?
I'd say it's fairly conservative. I think that I'm quite interested in exploring melodic ideas and supporting them with harmonic structures that I tend to invent myself. I'm also very interested in counterpoint. I teach a bit of counterpoint. I'd like to be able to teach more counterpoint. I'd like to be better at counterpoint. But I do think it's one of those tools that is sometimes, underrated. maybe because it's seen as old-fashioned, but I don't think that it is. I think it's really important. It's a really important technical skill, and I'd like to be better at it, so I try and use counterpoint in a lot of my compositions.
I love that you say that you'd like to be better at it, because to me, and I'm sure to many of our listeners, it will seem that you've made it. You have a fantastic career teaching at university. You have some brilliant compositions behind you. Do you feel there'll ever be a point where you feel comfortable knowing all you know and feel you need to stop learning, or is that just a process that will always be there for you?
I think I'll be learning forever. As long as I'm writing music, I'll be learning something new, because I will often look back at pieces and think, wow, I just wish I had done that little corner differently, or I wish that I had, you know, I'd like to be able to fix that bit, or there's that rhythmic thing which doesn't work quite well. And so you do learn from old pieces. I'm not a huge advocate for doing, you know, 29 revisions of pieces. I may do one revision of a piece, but I think I'd rather just move on and write another piece and try and do something differently and then learn from that. There's orchestrational things. I don't claim at all to be, you know, an amazing orchestrator. And there's things about orchestration that I think I would like to learn to do better as well. And the only way really to learn to do these things better is to just keep writing pieces. It's not like you can learn all these techniques and then finally you can say, right, I've learned everything, now I can compose, and you start composing. I think it's completely the other way around. And that's actually a serious comment, because I did have that once from a student as a complaint in many ways. He said, I want to learn about how to do composition, how to do counterpoint, how to do harmony, how to do orchestration. When are we going to learn all that stuff before we write our pieces? And I thought, no, you've got that round the wrong way. You learn that through writing your pieces. That's why it's such a slow process, and it's such a long-term process of learning. So I think it's a lifelong learning thing.
In that way, how can a young musician ever necessarily feel confident in writing their early pieces and putting them out there, knowing that there's so much that they have to learn?
Yes, I think it's a real dilemma. Small steps. Yeah, try not to throw everything in your one piece. You know, think about, okay, this piece I'm going to deal with pitch, and work on your skills with constructions of pitches and harmonies, and then see how that goes, and then write another piece that's only a rhythm piece. Maybe you write a piece that doesn't have a pitched instrument. Maybe you write something for snare drum and tom-tom, where you explore rhythmic interest. In that way, I've actually constructed a sort of a compositional sequence of tasks for composition students who are in my undergraduate course at the University of Tasmania. And so they work through various projects, and each project is meant to focus on a particular technique of composition. So they might also write a piece that needs to explore a certain type of form. So they need to go and study binary form, ternary form, arch form, go and find out what the golden mean is, and then work on a piece that emphasises form.
I'd like to know about what you're working on at the moment. Do you have any composition in the works, or is it a secret?
I do, actually. No, oh. I've been very fortunate to be commissioned by a local brass quintet. They're all TSO players, the Epsom Brass, and they asked me to write them a piece. It's a bit of a long-term project, but the piece is beyond halfway finished. So I've already had written two movements and workshopped it with the players, and they seem to be pretty happy with it so far. So that's for two trumpets, French horn, tenor trombone and bass trombone.
Writing for Epsom, which is a chamber ensemble.
Yeah.
How have you experienced writing for chamber music in the past, and what are some of your chamber works that you're most proud of?
I've had a number of really fun commissions. Probably three of the most exciting commissions that I had one was for a piano trio, which was a piece called A Feather of Blue that the New Zealand trio commissioned in 2000. And in the same year, I also wrote a piece for flute and alto flute, clarinet and piano, and that one's called Poems of a Bright Moon. And that gets performed a lot, actually. It's performed by about four or five ensembles in the US. And it's going to be performed in Chicago too.
Congratulations.
Thank you. And then one of the most fun commissions I had was this great subscriber from the Australia Ensemble in Sydney, and this gentleman wanted to commission a work to celebrate an important anniversary of the number of years he'd been living in Australia. He came from South Africa originally, and he was given a short list of three women composers, I believe, to commission a piece from, and he chose me, and so I wrote him a piece for the Australia Ensemble, and that piece is called 10 Suns Ablaze, and that actually won the Tasmanian State Award for from the Australian Classical Music Awards in 2013. So
fantastic.
Yeah, I'm very fond of that piece, and I'm very fond of the commissioner as well.
I saw not long ago one of your works performed by the TSO. It was in a Carnival of the Animals concert, I believe. What was the name of the work?
It was called Raw. It was a children's piece that I was commissioned to write a number of years ago by West Australian Symphony.
Yes. Even though you've been doing this for decades now, how does that feel to still hear your own piece played in the orchestra to a full concert hall?
It's actually quite nerve-wracking. I'm a little bit more relaxed when it's pieces that have been performed before. For new pieces, I do get incredibly nervous. But it's very flattering that people program the pieces, and I'm very lucky with that particular piece. It tends to, it's had a really good life, and it gets performed quite regularly around the country. I think possibly because it suits a particular descriptive. It was commissioned actually with the expectation that it would be about the circus, and so it was for an education concert. So that's where it tends to be used.
How did you bring the circus and those sorts of themes into the music?
I decided that the piece would be in sections, each section showcasing a particular section of the orchestra. So the opening section is more prominent for the woodwinds, and it's meant to depict things like jugglers and monkeys just doing very rhythmical acts. And then the second section is a bit to convey the trapeze artist. So it goes into 3-4 and it's more of a waltz, and it's a little bit like, it has a little bit of a hint of Prokofiev about it. And the third section is the percussion, and particularly using the instrument the lion's roar, which actually does sound like a lion's roar. And I also have the whip in there, so it's kind of the old lions coming around, running around the circus tent with the lion tamers in the middle, cracking the whip and holding a chair and all of that old-fashioned circus stuff. And then the fourth section, the brass come in and they kind of join in with the percussion, and then all the instruments come back to have a big, loud, noisy finale.
And noisy it was indeed.
Yes, it was very noisy. The idea was that conductors, there's a little bit of separation between sections, like a pause, so the conductors can actually stop and then turn around to an audience of children and say, now the next section is going to be about the strings and this is what you might like to listen for. And then they could play that section, and then they can run the whole piece continuously.
Do you find when you're working on a composition where you need to keep individual sections and players in mind, do you find that it's you can't be as creatively expressive as you'd like?
It can be frustrating, but at the same time, each particular project is different. And so if you have certain restrictions in order to get the project done, your creativity is actually challenged more, because you have to come up with an idea, like a solution to solve the problem in a way. And so you really need to have pretty good technique, I think, to be able to work around a particular brief where you have certain parameters that are provided for you. When you're writing a piece where there are no parameters, it can be a little bit more difficult to come up with solutions to problems, because those problems really aren't there. But if you, or there are different sets of problems. But if you know that you have certain restrictions, then it's important that you honour those restrictions and follow them, because that's the job. So it becomes more like almost like a job for hire sort of thing. But not all commissions are like that. Some commissions are, here's the instrumentation, we want a 15-minute piece, here's the deadline, see you at the end sort of thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
at the moment, you've been approached by a few different ensembles and musicians to write, regardless of whether there's money involved or not. And I'm very curious that as a composer who's spent a long time in the industry, you're still happy to write music even when you don't get a fee for your work.
If it's a piece that I really would like to write, then I wouldn't like to say no, if I have the time to do it and if I can fit it in. Also, sometimes performers will, you know, they'll be very keen to have a piece from me, and they know that if they can't pay me, is there something else that they might be able to offer in exchange? And for a composer, the opportunity to have your piece performed is one that you shouldn't turn down as much as possible, particularly from a, you know, really high caliber musician. I know that I'm really fortunate that I have a job that I can afford to write pieces for people without expecting a fee to live on, because I already have a job. So I am lucky.
Do you think it's important for musicians to be paid for what they do in general?
Yes, I think it's crucial that musicians are paid for what they do. But there are other ways of being paid if you have the time and commitment to do the project in the first place. It's important that both parties are comfortable with the arrangement. I do think musicians should be paid for their time, absolutely.
Do you find that when you do get commissions from ensembles or orchestras, are people quite compassionate about the needs of the composer, how long they might need to take with something, or the engagement with the ensemble they might need?
Yes, they are. Sometimes people commission something with a particular performance date in mind, and so you have to be mindful of that. And also they do as well. It's not really very fair to ask a composer, you know, for something that's a month away unless it's really short. So usually composers get a little bit more time than that. Yeah.
Mm. What do you do if you come to that date, or you see that it's looming and you have writer's block or composer's block?
I think it's more about discipline and regular work sessions, and kind of just sitting down in front of the computer or in front of your piece of paper, and just, even if nothing comes, at least you're actually in the moment and you're focusing on what you're doing. And if you do that on a regular basis, then gradually you will start to, I think that it should work, that you start to actually think, no, I can come up with an idea. Even if what you write down is not something that you really like, the more you do it, the better it gets, and then you can go back and review. I say this also very idealistically, because it can be very difficult to write when you really feel that you've got writer's block. I think having a lot of practice writing, so the more experience you have, the better it gets. And it's really important to kind of parcel out time in your day, whether or not it's at night, if you can work at night, or whether it's early in the morning, or if it's a time during the day. It's important to actually set that time aside.
Mm-hmm. Mm. Are you still figuring this out as you
go? Yes, yeah. Very much so.
What do you do to unwind and relax when you have a moment to? Do you have a moment to?
Yes, I do. I've been reading quite a lot recently, just because I enjoy getting back to reading. I think it's important for composers to have, for anyone who's doing something that requires a lot of brain activity and a lot of deep thought and introspection, to have some time where they don't have to think so hard about anything, because that gives your brain a rest and it gives your body an opportunity to recharge as well. And and talking to people and having conversations with friends can lead you to think about things that you haven't really thought about before, and that can then in turn affect how you think about what you're working on.
Is there any final message or word of advice that you would like to give to young musicians or composers at the start of their career who have to face these challenges along the way?
Yes, a few things that I would say that really helped me. One of them is to learn as much skill writing music as possible. And by that I mean, do your voice leading, do your harmony, do your counterpoint, practice your oral skills, do read your textbooks, you know, all those kinds of traditional things. I still think there is a huge importance in getting skills, because it's not just about creativity. If you can't actually put it down on the paper in a coherent way, then you are quite limited in how you can then pass your music on to others who need to make sense of it. The more skill you bring to your work, the better it will be, because then you can really convey what your ideas are. Secondly, I would suggest lots of listening. Listen to old music, listen to middle-aged music, listen to new music. Don't discount old music. And by listening, I don't just mean sort of, you know, listening while you're doing something else or while you're watching television. Actually sit down and listen in silence and follow scores. I think that's really important. A lot of composition students find it difficult to follow scores because they're not used to it. It's a YouTube generation. People listen by watching YouTube. They listen by watching rather than reading a score and just listening.
What sort of things should we be looking for in the score when we're following along? How can we get the most out of reading with a score?
I think you can get a lot out of looking at what the composer has done with the distribution of ideas across the different instruments that are on the page. And sometimes that can look completely different on the page to what you imagine it does if you're only listening to it. And what you want is to try and make that connection between how it sounds and how the composer has actually written it down. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I would also say that form relationships with your peers, because in 20 years' time, those people are the ones who are putting together concert series. They are founding ensembles. They are commissioning composers. They are organising festivals. So you really want to build relationships with people around you, and, you know, all work together for the common good, if it makes sense too.
Thank you, Maria. I have one final question for you. If you could invite any composer to your house for a dinner party, who would it be?
That's a great question. I have a very good friend, and I regard him as my composition mentor, and his name is Stephen Hartke, and he's a composer who now lives in Ohio, and he and his wife have stayed with us, and I would just be really chuffed to see him again. He's very entertaining, and he's a brilliant, brilliant composer, so it'd be really neat to see him again.
That's lovely. I hope he can actually come around to
us. So do I.
Thank you so much. We'll leave it there, Maria. Good luck.
Thanks,
with your Stephanie. With your work.
Thank you.
Podcast is brought to you by Making Waves. Making Waves is a free online listening resource bringing listeners the latest new music from Australian composers. We'd love for you to discover, listen, like, subscribe, and share new Australian music. You can find us at makingwavesnewmusic.com. We'd like to thank all of the people who made this season possible. This includes the supporters of our crowdfunding campaign, Project Patron Cameron Lamb of Camaclang, and Creative Partnerships Australia's match funding program. The series production team is Leah Blankendahl, Stephanie Eslake, Sasha Kelly, David John Lang, Matthew Lorenzen, Rebecca Aaron-Smith, Chris Williams, Antonia Zappia, Daniel Thorpe, Thomas Green, Lisa Cheney and Peggy Pelias, along with interns Angus Baxter, Marlena Radice and Mark Wolf. The podcast theme music was the work I/O by Australian composer Ellie Simic-Prozic. If you wish to learn more about the composer, music, or interviewer featured in this episode, head to our website and click podcast to view the show notes. If you're enjoying these podcasts from Making Waves, there are a number of ways in which you can show your support, either by subscribing to this podcast via iTunes or your favourite app. You might even like to leave a review. You can also share this episode and the series with your networks. Making Waves is a voluntary endeavour. If you're interested in volunteering or interning with us, we'd love to hear from you. We also encourage you to consider making a small one-off or continuing donation to support the ongoing promotion of new Australian music and composers. Visit makingwavesnewmusic.com/support for more.